We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
Millions around the world have waited for. Waited for years. Many doubted we'd ever see it. But here it is. The return to glory.
Middays on the Score.
All the schmaltz is there for you, and if ever there's a time for it, that's the time for it. That is, you got to accept that it's coming with the territory and just revel in it at this point, which is kind of what we're doing. We're celebrating a great sports moment today and putting it in some context. Appreciating it might be a better word. Brian Wacker of Golf Digest joins us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. You can follow Brian on Twitter at BrianWacker1, and he's the host of the Playing Through podcast. It was quite a thing yesterday, Brian, was it not?
You know, going back to that clip you just played at Jim Nantz, and I wrote this in my column last night, you go back to Tiger's first win at Augusta National, his call was a win for the ages. And that was certainly a comeback for the ages, what we saw yesterday. You touched on a lot of that just now, but boy, it was an electric scene. I've covered a bunch of Masters now, and I've never seen anything like it. It was incredible.
Brian, we were talking earlier about the gravity that Tiger had back in his real dominant stretch where other golfers would just kind of crumble as he marched his way to the end and the finish and a win. Did it feel that way to you again here, or was it just circumstance that you had Molinari going into everybody going into Ray's Creek and him just playing steady Eddie, but also still being Tiger?
Well, I'm not sure it's quite the same as it was, but it's hard to look at Francesco Molinari and not think that, particularly on the 12th hole, hitting it in the water there. How about this? Four of the six players in the last two groups hitting it in the water on 12 in a Rays Creek. Tiger, of course, did not. And that was sort of the seminal moment, the turning point in this golf tournament for Tiger. That's where the experience came in. That's where the knowledge to not go at that back right flag came in and to play it safe and aim left and be long and hit it in the middle of the green there on the left-hand side. Certainly, you have to think that Molinari was feeling the weight of it hitting in the water there. And then again on 15, inexplicably catching it a little heavy and then having his ball hit a tree branch and get knocked down into the water. So, this was shades of the old Tiger for sure.
How much did conditions then play to what are now his remaining strengths? And that he's not going to be bombing away and obviating the structure of the course in the way that he once did. But once there's wind, and once there are issues with the landing areas, the putting surface, putt speeds, the amount of roll, etc., the guy who knows this course encyclopedically can win with his head as much as anything else.
Absolutely. We saw that yesterday in the shot on 12 being a perfect example. He knows better than to try to take on that flag, particularly with everything that was going on around him and well aware of where he was and where everyone else was on the leaderboard. So you look at how he dissected that hole. Sure, he had problems with the lengthened fifth hole. And to your point, this is not a guy who is going to dominate golf courses and dominate the field with his length the way he did 20 years ago. That said, he's made some changes. He still hits it a long ways to keep up with these younger players, and he's still one of the best ball strikers in the history of the game. And at Augusta National, that goes a long way. And of course, we saw it the short game, the knowledge there. I mean, go back to Sunday night before the final round. Tiger on the golf course late in the day Sunday with just a wedge. walking around the golf course, hitting different chip shots, different pitch shots, sort of refamiliarizing himself with all the little nuances of Augusta National. And to me, you know, for all that he has been through physically, mentally, none of that seems to affect his golf IQ, and that is probably his strongest suit as he continues this incredible comeback.
Talking about one of the greatest sporting events in modern sports history with Brian Wacker of the Golf Digest here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. Many have much more qualified than I have weighed in on this, and I figured we ask a professional on this. Can he win more? I mean, does it? I sat Sunday just kind of enjoying it and wondering a little bit whether or not he could win another major championship and chase down Jack, but I didn't want to let that kind of outweigh what had happened. Are you looking forward at all, or just kind of letting it be what it was?
Well, you're right. I mean, that's an excellent point to, I think we should all sort of let this soak in, focus on the accomplishment and the incredible achievement of winning that 15th major. And that question actually came up to Tiger in his post-round press conference, and he effectively said, look, I'm going to enjoy this and let it soak in. We're, you know, barely an hour after the fact. But I thought it was very it was important that he said, you know, look, I can win majors now. He knows that he can win major championships. You go back to last year, it was about, and I talked to his caddy, Joe LaCava, for my story for GolfDigest.com, which you can read there. He talked last year, it was about just getting back into the flow, getting reps, winning a golf tournament, which he did at the Tour Championship in Atlanta. This year, he'd already accomplished that. It was about winning a major. And Tiger said he'd been preparing for this tournament for 6 months, been working on the types of shots he'd need to be able to execute them under the gun, and that's what we saw. So, yeah, I don't think the pursuit of Jack Nicklaus's record, you know, once that was not all that long ago, that was sort of a question that didn't matter. Now I think it's a relevant question again, and it is incredible that we're actually having that conversation because this was a guy who just a couple of years ago, many, including Tiger himself, thought he might never play again. So that we've gone from that point to this point in 2 years, I think it's not out of the question that Tiger could potentially catch Jack now.
See, it's funny. I look at it oppositely. I think it matters less than ever. Despite the fact that it might happen separately, Tiger Woods is the best golfer who's ever walked the planet. I have not a single doubt in my mind. When he catches and surpasses Sam Snead, it has to do with relative to the level of competition. And it's sort of the same argument in some ways when we had our guy Joe Sheehan on, who says Mike Trout is the best baseball player ever because baseball players are way better now than they used to be. And we're sort of putting a Jaws score on like a Hall of Fame candidacy. I don't have and I don't think it's really even close before this or after this. We're going after this idea of catching Nicklaus only because that number happens to be there. Brian, I don't think he needs it. I don't really think it's close.
No, I don't think it. Look, Tiger's legacy is already cemented, and I would agree with you. I think Nicklaus's achievement was maybe the greatest in the sport, and that's 18 major championships, 19 runner-ups. People forget that. 19 runner-ups in majors, 18 wins. So that's 37 times that he finished first or second, which is remarkable. That said, Tiger Woods has played better golf than anybody in the history of the sport has ever played, bar none. So to your point, look, whether he gets to 18 or not, his legacy is already cemented. That said, the fact that we're even having the conversation, I think it's not implausible to think he could catch Nicklaus's record. You look at Beth Page coming up next month. You look at Pebble Beach the month after that for the U.S. Open. These are golf courses he has won it before and played extremely well, knows it very well. Of course, there'll be other trips to Augusta National. Remember, Jack Nicklaus won there at age 46 in 1986 for his last major victory. So not out of the realm of the conversation that Tiger could win another one, maybe two green jackets. So that brings 18 back into the play. But to your point, No, look, his legacy is cemented. He is the best player that's ever played this game. And Jack's achievement is simply the greatest achievement. And it's incredibly fun and amazing to think that we're actually having the conversation again of whether he can catch Jack Nicklaus or not.
Well said. I think that's a really good way of putting it.
I want to go back to Saturday real quickly with you, Brian, if you can. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but the network's decision to push the thing up and the course's decision to push it up in the morning. Did you hear any – how did players take that news? Was there any grumbling whatsoever? I just wonder what the scene was like for the individual competitors as we got to Sunday, because so many of us just kind of woke up and threw the thing on. Those guys went through something just a little bit different. Was there any kind of – any sense of anything different, or is it just kind of golf?
No, it was definitely different because it was an odd sort of rhythm and pace of the morning because particularly Masters Sunday, it's such an event and there's such a build-up to the conclusion, and there's this time for emotion and thoughts to build up over the course of the day. You see how the golf course is playing. You see what's happening. There's the anticipation of the final groups going out, and I'm standing outside the Augusta Clubhouse in the back there, and you know, here comes Zach Johnson out, and he heads to the 10th tee, and you know, he was a bunch of shots back, 10 or 11 or 12 shots back, and then moments later, here comes Francesco Molinari, the guy leading the tournament, heading toward the first tee, and then of course Tiger Woods after that. So, and there was a throng of people, and Zach actually had a funny joke with it, you know, thanks guys for being out here for me, but there's a weird rhythm. You know, all the tables where people are typically dining, you know, having their lunch on the back lawn behind the clubhouse at Augusta, all those tables are empty. People were still getting to the golf course because the traffic was kind of chaotic. So there was a sort of disjointed, chaotic nature to it at the outset. But then, of course, you get into the golf, and it really just becomes about the golf, especially once you hit that back nine. And it was a wild day, no doubt about it. I mean, look, you had six players who had to share the lead at one point or another. And, of course, Tiger is the guy who emerges. But look, players are used to it, certainly, these sorts of things happening throughout the course of a season. But it was definitely odd to see it in a major, and particularly the Masters, which is a tournament that has a certain rhythm and cadence to it. That just wasn't there on Sunday.
And it certainly brought out some of the drama here, this idea of it being as quiet, the patrons as reserved. It would be different to watch him control his emotions at, like, the Waste Management Open or something like that. I mean, the fact that we had this sort of emotional simmer going on really lent itself to our enjoyment as spectators, too. No question.
Yeah, absolutely. But you look at Tiger, and he comes walking out, just all business, straight away to the putting green and then the first tee. But there was that lack of sort of build-up, and then, of course, it gets recaptured. Once you make that turn to the back nine, there's so much that can go on. And there, obviously, again, this is the one tournament, guys, that every year just delivers on cue, back nine, every Sunday, every year, without fail, and it did it again.
Great stuff, Brian. Thanks a lot for being available for us today.
You got it.
That is Brian Wacker of Golf Digest, who can be followed on Twitter at BrianWacker1. Segment brought to you by Timeshare Exit Team. Can't use your timeshare, can't sell it or give it away. If it's time to get out of your timeshare, it's time to call Timeshare Exit Team. Call 844-915-EXIT, 844-915-EXIT, or visit TimeshareExitTeam.com.
The Midday Midway is on the way. We'll break up some of this. I've got a team-building exercise that we may all have to take a vacation for. I also have a lawsuit that is all kinds of randy.
I got scary birds. I've got a bird on the loose in Chicago, and I have urban coyotes doing God's work.
The Midday Midway is on the way. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
the first half or the second half. You know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on the Score.
First half of the show, we celebrated a major sports accomplishment. One of the biggest sports stories of my lifetime, without question. Tiger Woods freaking won the Masters yesterday. Tiger Woods won the Masters yesterday.
Incredible. An incredible, incredible achievement. Just, and something I never thought I'd see after the last decade.
And we got out of the Tyler Chatwood start.
That was so nice, too.
Celebrating that, too. Also, an important part of the sports weekend was avoiding the Tyler Chatwood start. And we talked with Brian Wacker about it and just tried to really appreciate what that was.
So this is this is a follow-up of a story that we had sniffed around a few months ago at the height of the Fortnite craze, but it seems as though it's all taking shape. There is an anonymous, probably billionaire, mounting a live-action Fortnite battle royale.
No!
Yes! IGN is reporting that a rich person, contacted the luxury curators Hush Hush to ask them if they could move beyond gaudy watches and helicopters to set up a 100-person deathmatch on a private island. We've moved beyond an era where encouraging outright murder is allowed, so the company got to work setting up an airsoft battle between participants wearing touch-sensitive armor. It's probably a lot more fun.
No, but actual murder?
Yes, but for the 99 people dead, there would be very little fun.
There's risk in life.
News got out about the match when Hush Hush posted an advertisement looking for a game maker to design the island. The unsettlingly chipper ad lays out the request. Here is
how do you do the storm, though? Do you have, like, people run in a circle?
Battle Royale. Royale games have become incredibly popular over the last few years, and our customer is a huge fan who wants to make the game a reality in the safest way possible. If the championship is a success this year, it's something he wants to make an annual event moving forward, which is very exciting. I have the website. We can apply to be part of the 100-person Battle Royale.
Oh, I'd be first guy dead.
Absolutely. You'd be so quickly you would be dead.
The moment I jumped off the battle bus.
What button do I press? It's a real thing, Dan. Bam! Right, dead. Right.
I can't even do the button one, let alone a real-life one. And how do they like do the chests and the gear?
The game making isn't out yet. They haven't. I don't think they want to release the particulars of the event because then the participants would be able to strategize it. I think part of it is you get dropped onto this island, you got to figure the thing out. That's also, cool. Not get shot.
A large flightless bird called the world's most dangerous attacked and killed its owner when the man fell on his farm in Florida. The Alachua, Florida County Sheriff's Office told CBS affiliate WGFL-TV that the man was killed by a cassowary on the property near Gainesville. He was apparently breeding these birds native to Australia and New Guinea. He was in the vicinity of the bird and he fell, and then he was attacked. He was rushed to a hospital for trauma care, but he died. 75-year-old Marvin Hayos. They said initial information indicates it was a tragic accident. The cassowary involved remains secured on private property at this time. Cassowaries, the world's most dangerous birds, are similar to emus. They stand up to 6 feet tall. They weigh up to 130 pounds. Black body feathers and distinctive bright blue heads and necks. The San Diego Zoo's website calls the cassowary the world's most dangerous, with a 4-inch dagger-like claw on each foot.
No, like a raptor claw?
It is the second heaviest bird in the world after its cousin, the ostrich. The cassowary can slice open any predator or potential threat with a single swift kick.
Whoa!
Powerful legs help the cassowary run up to 31 miles an hour through dense forest underbrush. It can also jump 7 feet in the air.
Nuh-uh.
This is a velociraptor.
Yeah.
Do not breed them. Do not have them on your property. What's one kick?
It's feathered death. What are you doing?
That is, it's a velociraptor.
Have you looked? Oh my God. Their claws, They're like twice the size of a human hand. Like the whole foot, it's almost twice the size of a human
but
hand.
But it's got a razor blade on there.
Oh my Lord. And they look like they want to kill you.
Yes.
A cassowary looks like it wants to kill. Like it was bred specifically, engineered on some like Dr. Moreau Island to kill humans.
Well, it did.
My God. This story comes to us from Appleton, Wisconsin, where a long-time long-time tradition there is now apparently over. A Fox City's restaurant is no longer okay. So Tom's Drive-In is a local fast food joint, right? Okay. There's five or six of them, and some have closed over the years. But there was a Tom's located by just about every high school that was in Appleton. West had one right down Wisconsin. There was one right down Prospect if you went to Xavier. The local hangouts, local drive. Good burgers, great shake, decent fries. You know, it was the whole thing. It was a greasy spoon kind of drive-in restaurant. What was tradition, though, is that for those of us like latchkey kids or like maybe your parents taught or just whatever, Appleton was very much like a walking town. You could walk from school to wherever. And Tom's Drive-In, for a lot of people, became a hangout for like high schoolers. You would go, the cool kids would kind of, so I didn't go a lot, but they would end up at Tom's just hanging out and causing general mischief.
Home away from home.
And entertaining and all that kind of stuff. I didn't realize that over the last couple of years, that trend had led more from high school kids to middle school kids.
Wow.
And that the trouble they were making was real and actual. They have apparently, Tom's Drive-In has banned middle school students. Due to mistreatment of Tom's Drive-In's property, guests, and staff.
Seventh and eighth graders?
Here's the thing posted on Tom's Drive-In doors. Due to mistreatment of Tom's Drive-In's property, guests, and staff, you are no longer allowed inside the building without parental supervision. For those who did not cause any of the incidents,
doing?
We are sorry for the inconvenience. You may still purchase food through the walk-up window. The manager says the mandate was put in place months ago after attempts of asking the kids to curb their behavior failed. The behavior included vandalism, like a booth the students carved into. The students also made large messes in the restaurant and bathroom, yelled profanities in the restaurant, including at the district manager, fought with customers, stole soda, drew genitalia with Sharpie markers, and tattooed each other with pen, ink, and needles, leaving bloody napkins behind.
What the hell, man?
Go Bears!
The restaurant says that policing the kids had become a full-time babysitting job for the crew during the after-school rush.
Kids should be gassed. I mean, seriously, they should be knocked out or tear-gassed.
Into a whole thing. And no longer are unattended minors allowed at Tom's Drive-In. A tradition has come to an end.
Unlike any other. The bottom of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Nothing beats playoff hockey in Chicago. You won't want to miss a single second at Allstate Arena. The first place Chicago Wolves look to defend their home ice advantage. For the latest playoff information and tickets, visit chicagowolves.com. There's a bird traveling around Chicago. It's not that big a deal, really, outside the city and the suburbs or out toward rural areas. But apparently there's a turkey running around Chicago. And a dog running around in the air ducts.
A wild turkey?
Wild turkey. Yeah, this is from the Trib that there have been sightings, and I have not seen it. Apparently it was seen around Evanston. And then apparently the same bird was seen in Rogers Park. And people are shooting pictures of it. Not quite sure where it lives, but there are birds we know are adapting to the city. We know raptors have adapted to our city famously. But apparently, this turkey has now been photographed on a first-floor balcony rail not far from Montrose Beach. Huh. Somebody saw it walking back from the Red Line stop at Wilson, Sunnyside, and Sheridan. Lots of sightings.
And
people are trying to figure out, triangulate.
And it's pretty rare. Like, we don't have turkeys running around the area?
No.
It's in the wooded lands?
Yeah, suburbs, you see them.
Okay.
Rockford has them all over the place.
Okay.
I mean, huge. You get up into Wisconsin, you see them everywhere. But
all
for
the time.
For an urban area, I'm waiting to see, because that will lead me to my next story.
This story is quite unparalleled. A Michigan man is suing his parents for $86,000
Wow.
for allegedly throwing out his massive porn collection.
I was going to say baseball cards.
According to a report. No, this family feud began in October 2016 when, following a divorce, the man moved back in with his parents in Grand Rapids, Michigan, bringing with him his $29,000 porn stockpile, according to a federal civil court document.
Of what, like DVDs? About who needs to actually have porn?
That is the first question I asked reading this story. Why would Dan McNeil move to Grand Rapids with his parents? Why?
It's on the cloud.
About 10 months later, the man who's...
Whenever you need it, if you want it.
The man's identity, who was withheld by the outlet, moved to a new home in Indiana, and his parents sent him his belongings. That's when he noticed that his collection... which consisted of over 12 moving boxes full of movies and two boxes of toys, were gone. The man tried calling the Ottawa County Sheriff's Office, sending one officer 44 emails listing the movies he says were destroyed, but authorities declined to press charges. Many of the movies are valuable and out of print, according to the lawsuit. The man emailed his parents, writing, "If you had a problem with my belongings, you should have stated that at the time, and I would have gone elsewhere. Instead, you chose to keep quiet and behave vindictively." According to the lawsuit, the father responded, "Believe it or not, one reason for why I destroyed your porn was for your own mental and emotional health. I would have done the same if I'd found a kilo of crack cocaine," his father added. "Someday, I hope you'll understand." We'll keep you posted on how this lawsuit ends, but why a man has to hold on to $86,000.
Old school.
Think about
it, too.
That's
old school behind the beaded curtain
stuff
there.
This man knows. He emailed lists of movies that were missing amidst an $86,000 collection.
So is that 12 boxes of VHSs?
That's what I'm wondering.
There's got to be VHS involved there. There has to be. He's like a laser disc, maybe?
It's like a porn museum.
It is.
He is Pornhub.
He is curated. Hello? He's curated this whole thing. I mean, he doesn't really have to do it. I hope he understands.
He's a dude there preparing.
This is a study by the National Park Service. And it's found that something really good is happening. You know, I love what's going on with coyotes in urban areas. I just think it's really cool. I love these stories of urban adaptation, and I live among it. There are coyotes all over the place where I live, and there are cameras that have been tracking them. They're actually understanding the crossing signals on Irving Park Road. There's video of them waiting for the walk signal to cross.
Amazing.
And most importantly, not only are they eating rats in Chicago, they are eating a lot of cats.
Oh.
That the National Park Service has been sifting through coyote poop. They're sifting out contents of also the stomachs of 300 coyotes that have become roadkill in cities.
Okay.
So they're going through what comes out the other end. They're going through what is in the stomachs. And they say that they have found baseballs, shoes, furniture, bedazzled jewels. They go into a machine for DNA extraction, and they have confirmed that at least a fifth of the coyote's diet is cats. 20%. Because these are feral cats, these are pet cats. Apparently,
the coyotes make the distinction, yes.
The coyotes have been drawn in because of fruit. They chase down ornamental fruit, red berries called pyracantha, and grapes. And once they're in the neighborhood, because of the fruit, they have found cats and small dogs, and then they have developed a taste.
Oh, so it's an opportunity dining.
Yes and no. It was, but these are canines that
learn. Oh,
but
now they've become their eyes.
Correct. I'm like, oh, yeah, well, we were looking for berries. Remember that other meal we had? Let's go back and find that. So there are apps now being used with crowdsourcing for people to report coyote attacks or near misses in their area, but... keep getting it done, coyotes. Do what you got to do, because feral cats are an absolute scourge, and I love to watch nature in action in the big city.
That is the Midday Midway. We do it every day here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. Amidst the golf yesterday, there was a whole bunch of snow, and it helped the Cubs out, believe it or not.
Yeah, it did.
Not having a Tyler Chatwood start. It's the snow out, the rain out that you and I wanted or hoped for earlier in the week, and they just happened to get it on Sunday. There will be a problem with the makeup dates. Somebody is going to have to go through this and jump through a whole bunch of hoops to make this game happen a little bit later in the season. But some ups, some downs, and one very, very angry Kyle Schwarber this weekend.
Awesome.
For the Chicago Cubs. We'll get into the weekend they had and what you need to see tonight. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
The 3-2 pitch from Cody Allen. Here it is. Low check swing, strike three, and the ball game is over. The ball game is over. Kyle Schwarber did not swing. He said he did not swing. Kyle is livid right now. He wants to go down and talk it over with Gabe Morales, the third base umpire, but the ball game is over. Schwarber ruled to have swung on a breaking ball in the dirt. The ball game is over. Joe Maddon is out arguing with Gabe Morales. The Angels have beaten the Cubs by a score of 6-5.
That was a game I kept coming back to. I kept going away from it, and then I would get a look at my phone, and I had MLB open on there. I'm like, you know, I
kept giving you reasons.
Yeah, I kept coming back. Well, here they go again, and then there's the error, and then they're in that situation. This segment, by the way, brought to you by Patrick Cadillac. Initially, I was with Kyle Schwarber, and every time I watched it, I was less with Kyle Schwarber.
Same.
And here's why. If you fixate on his wrists and you fixate on the head of the bat, independently, he checked his swing, but not when you actually bring in the movement of his body.
I thought he had intent to swing. I thought he it was a late check, and don't tell Kyle because I think he's still very angry about it. He's got every right to be, but I think he went. I would love for there to be an actual rule on the rule book, though, about a check. I don't know how you would do it, but the fact that it's left up the interpretation of the umpire kind of sucks.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do, though.
No, there's really not a... Joe said after the game that he'd prefer some sort of electronic monitoring on that, some sort of actual hard and fast piece of equipment that would... You broke the plane, it's a touch, you know, like the things in the Olympic swimming pools, you just kind of graze it a little bit and the light goes off and you win the race and all that. There's no way to actually do that. And to be honest, I was less upset with his at-bat. You know, going 3-2.
Oh, Wilson Contreras, what are you doing?
My man, that was a horrendous late game AB.
What's your plan?
He didn't have one, it didn't seem. And I don't think he realized that the Angels left first base open so that Cody Allen didn't have to throw him a damn strike. That's tough to have to watch. You get a catcher's interference rule against Tommy La Stella, too. I got a text from some guy at the game. It's like, how clueless do you have to be to allow a catcher's interference to Tommy La Stella? That's what he does. The man draws these things like it's part of his game.
Yeah, I always had a theory about that. That if you were a left-handed hitter and you had used a really long bat.
You wouldn't need much.
And choked Wade down and stood in the back of the box.
Just kind of threw it at the glove.
Could you not make a market inequity out of being catcher's interference guy?
You could draw a handful. There's no doubt about it. LaStella's got
one
base.
I pictured Juan Pierre doing that.
I don't think his limbs are quite long enough. And he was up in the box usually, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you need to be like a Mickey Tettleton stance up there.
The big reach back, big sweep in your swing, something
Craig
Counsell like that.
Towards the end.
Yeah, Counsell toward the end. Do that too. But he's, you know, it's just with Wilson, it's great that he's, for the most part, hit the way he's hit. But that, I mean, there were moments where Victor Caratini, before he got hurt, some of his catch framing numbers, the games he's calling, the defensive ability he's got behind the plate. Wilson Contreras, it seems to me, is a catcher that still needs a lot of work as a catcher, just defensively, despite the fact that he has an outstanding, elite level of athleticism and arm talent for being a catcher.
However, you don't have to show it off for no reason. There's so many times where he'll leap up and throw the mask away.
And it's maddening.
It's like, what throw do you think you're making here?
I've even come around on that a little bit, as maddening as that can be. We talked to Joe about it at some point last season.
Maddening.
And it was, it really was. And it's part of, like he mentioned it, I have trust in that, in the herky-jerky, like, hero throws that he makes, because he's so good at them. And the ability to create outs on the base paths while you've got runners out there, that's such a plus for them that taking any one of those guys, taking more of those guys down than letting the extra 90 feet happen is more valuable to you, because you never know which guy checks up and doesn't go to third on what, you know, or doesn't go to second because that threat's back there. I've even come back on being uncomfortable watching him do that. It's just the basic receiving. It's just the extra couple of inches, the extra pitches here or there that he's not getting. Other catchers are, and that this pitching staff is going to end up needing.
I thought you were going to go in a different direction, thinking it's one thing for some idiot slugger up there to have a bad at-bat in a crucial situation and not understand what's happening.
Get back to the at-bat if you want.
He's your catcher.
Yeah.
Like, see, to me, it's magnified because he already has outsized responsibility to understand game situations. That's your defensive quarterback. He's got to know. He's got to know that there isn't a very good chance that he's going to see a hittable pitch. And I don't know what he's looking for. I don't know what he's hunting for. I know he's trying to bait the pitcher into doing, but absolutely nothing that he was trying to do worked.
It wasn't pretty. I did you think Javi Baez was going to go try and score on the error? Because I did.
I thought maybe.
I absolutely thought he was going to Javi that thing.
And it looked like he... was about to.
Apparently, he got about 80% of the way down to third base. As piecing them together and from some reporting from the game, he got like 80% of the way down to third, then had to think about it and then work himself back, which he probably would have never have made it. Had he decided to just go, it would have been absolutely entertaining, potentially calamitous, and a whole bunch of fun. I thought he was going to Javi Baez his way around. But really, for that weekend... when you've got outings from two starters like that, that went deep into ball games and commanded some stuff, Cole Hamels was terrific, even if he did give up some hard contact, that's really refreshing. You will need more of those, and it puts this series against one of the worst offenses in baseball into pretty clear territory.
You know what this is? This is a Theo Epstein urgency series. This is one, when you talked about the games you were going to circle, sweep this series.
I think in that way,
sweep it.
For that reason, this is one of those starts where you can look at Yu Darvish and go, it's 75 and sunny, big guy. I mean, this is, everything's going to be in line
here.
No
blister.
Your travel's good. Your health is good. The conditions are going to be good.
It's not a former team.
It's all going to be, and there's just a bunch of, do you know who leads the Marlins? The Marlins in offensive war? The man on top of the Marlins offense right now, leading the charge for the fish.
I have no clue.
It is the 35-year-old Martin Prado.
Of course it is.
Who is still in baseball. I didn't know that. I watch a lot. I didn't know that he's slashing .462, .500, .577 in his 28 plate appearances. I did not know that. The Marlins are 26th in weighted on base average. They're 26th in weighted runs created plus. They are horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Sweep this series.
And for Yu Darvish, it's have a good one. You know, you can, shouldn't be a game plan, but if that 94-mile-an-hour fastball that you gave up to Starling Marte, if that travels across the plate in that same spot in this one, you'll probably get away with it more times than you would against the Pirates. The margin for error here is nice. It's comfortable. This is hopefully a start where you can look at Yu Darvish. I've told you all season long that the Cubs kind of have to manage the Yu Darvish they've got, not the one that everybody wants him to be. This is maybe a start that you can let him work harder because of the offense he's facing.
The top of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Nothing beats playoff hockey in Chicago, and you won't want to miss a single second at Allstate Arena as the first place Chicago Wolves look to defend their home ice advantage. For the latest playoff information or tickets, visit ChicagoWolves.com. Richard Deitch is going to join us. It was a deal big enough that Sports Illustrated did one of their rare wordless covers for Michael Rosenberg's cover story about Tiger Woods. It is just a picture. Trying to think the last time they did that. I know the aforementioned Miracle on Ice merited that, just the photo.
Did it?
I would wonder how many times we've gotten a wordless SI cover, what that says about the size of this story. He's the perfect guy to talk to. So we're going to. Richard Deitch next on Bernstein and McKnight on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.